Good evening, friends. This is Franz Weinschenk, pleased to introduce another edition of Valley Writers Read. And tonight, we're going to hear two stories, both of them about one of America's favorite games, golf. The first one is by Angelo Angarano, and he entitles his story, Born Again Golfer. And then our second story, about the same subject, by David Creighton, is entitled Golf, a Four-Lettered Word. And here are Angelo and Dave to read their stories for us.
The Born Again Golfer by Angelo P. Angarano. On his 53rd birthday, after he had been playing golf for 20 years, Ugo Rondello said, "I've had enough of this dumb game. After all, I'm a high school graduate. How can any well-educated person maintain any sense of human dignity by seriously pursuing the absurdity of trying to strike a ball down a fairway, then attempting to put it into a flag-marked small hole in a large expanse of green? Why?" he asked his wife, Teresa. She just shrugged her response. "It's a real hard game, I know, but it's plain silly, Teresa," he said. "Over the years, I've spent a lot of time and money on lessons, and I have read a dozen books on the game. Why? I never shot better than an 89. I was just another one of the countless misguided men and women of all ages, posing on the course, wearing funny clothes, who imagine themselves champion golfers, carefully and seriously analyzing every stroke, and demanding absolute silence during a shot. It's a dumb game." "If you say so," Teresa answered indifferently. Ugo had expressed his feelings about the game's absurdity for many years, especially when he played very poorly and had to make excuses for the quality of his game. Yet he continued to play. "Teresa, let me read to you part of this article from Golf Magazine in which the author, a PhD in sports psychology, says, 'The real reason that golfers play with such seriousness and intensity and feel such pleasure and satisfaction when they hit a ball well is buried deep in the unconscious mind and is rooted in man's need to defend himself. In the dawn of his evolving brain, he saw that he could use a part of a tree limb as a weapon to crush his enemy's skull and thus effectively defend himself. But now the enemy is no longer a human being, but a golf ball, and the tree limb has evolved into the space-age golf club. So while this self-defense need still exists, its primitive aggressive expression is no longer socially acceptable. So this primal need has been sublimated, ritualized, and raised to the level of a game with complicated rules and whose expert practitioners have now become very wealthy and have been raised to near godlike status. This analysis might also explain the feelings of euphoria, victory, and intense satisfaction and pride that golfers experience after crushing the ball with a mighty blow. In this sense, therefore, modern golf is a kind of therapy. Do you believe this is why I played golf? I needed therapy because I wanted to crush my enemy's skull, and that really I was sick? Well, I've played for 20 years, so if the expert psychologist's explanation is true, whatever sickness or aggression that I may have had against my enemies all those years has finally been extinguished. So I quit the game because I no longer needed the therapy that the game is supposed to provide. I am cured. But does this mean that all those guys who still play are sick?" He asked his wife, who was washing dishes. "Ugo, I don't know," she said impatiently. "The high-priced scholarly explanation is all baloney. It's really only a simple, fun game. I quit because I wasn't having any fun, and I don't need any stupid psychology crap to explain why I was attracted to the game in the first place. Ugo, how should I know? After all, I didn't graduate from high school like you, so I don't understand all these complicated ideas you were talking about. After many years of his often publicly expressed resolve not to play again, he finally quit. But his friends and relatives frequently tried to tease and wheedle him into a return to the game. Even his wife, Teresa, urged him to take up the game again. It will get you out in the fresh air more often. It will be healthy for you. You could make new friends. Carmine Endivia, his brother-in-law, attempted to support her argument by adding, "After all, you now have the money, the not leisure, the standing in the community to pursue the game again. People will look up to you. They will say, 'Look at Ugo Rondello. He's a somebody now. He came from poor, uneducated Italian immigrant parents, but he made it, so now he can play golf with $1,000 set of clubs.' It will remind the world of your success. You could now seriously enjoy this absurd game just like the other rich society people. Ugo, other friends would say, you could make many contacts on the golf course. This will be good for your business." But he would not be persuaded. On a quiet Sunday afternoon, Carmine and his wife Giovanna, Teresa's sister, were visiting the Rondellos. "Ugo, let's go to the driving range while the girls are visiting. You don't have anything else better to do. You can watch me hit a ball or two and talk about golf. And I want you to meet the new pro. He's a Zen Buddhist master." "Wow, ain't that a strange combination?" Ugo reluctantly agreed. At the driving range, Carmine scuffed, hooked, sliced, and missed a few shots completely. His anger mounting, "Damn it, I've been playing this stupid game for 20 years and I never seem to get any better, and I just had a lesson last week." Ugo was about to say that maybe Carmine was simply a very slow learner, but instead he said, "With all due respect, Carmine, if you don't mind my saying so, your backswing is too fast, and you're raising your head too soon, and you're lunging at the ball. You're also changing your grip slightly at the top of your swing." "Really?" Carmine said, showing signs of irritation. "Why don't you show me, wise guy?" as he handed him the 3-wood. Ugo teed up a ball, addressed it, waggled a few times, raised the club and swung in an arc that brought the club face in perfect contact with the ball. It flew 200 yards straight down the range. He teed up another ball, swung, and duplicated the perfection of the first drive. "That is how you do it," he said, surprised at his own performance, as he smiled and returned the club to Carmine. The new pro at the range was standing nearby and had witnessed Ugo's drives. He approached, greeted Carmine, and then introduced himself to Ugo. "I'm Desmond Fujisaki. I'm the new pro here. By the way, those were 2 excellent shots. Your form was terrific. You must be a very serious student of the game." "No," Ugo said. "I'm just a 53-year-old used-to-be golfer. This is the first time I've held a club in my hands in 2 years." "Even so, those were excellent shots. Maybe you are a natural, an intuitive player, one who understands what we Zen Buddhists call golf nature. Perhaps that's why you hit the ball so well after a long layoff. All the true legendary players of the world have this knowledge. However, I must add that although one has the knowledge of golf nature, that doesn't mean that one automatically becomes a great golfer. It only means that without it, one can never become a great golfer. When a golfer has and knows golf nature, we call that person blessed and enlightened. That's interesting, Ugo said, not quite understanding what Fujisaki was saying. They exchanged a few more comments about golf nature, and Ugo and Carmine decided to leave. They all shook hands and said the customary things in the ritual of departure. On the way home, Ugo kept hearing Fujisaki's flattering comment, "You must be a natural, one who might have but does not understand golf nature. If I have it, then does this mean that at my age I could still become a great golfer? But for 20 years I have played mostly a poor game. Maybe I don't have it, yet Fujisaki thought I did. On the other hand, if I had it and was using it, how come I played so poorly most of the time? Is it possible to have it but not use it? What could have prevented me from using it? Is it possible to have it but only to express it intermittently? But I did shoot a couple of excellent drives after a 2-year layoff. That surely must mean something," Ugo thought. They drove in silence and came to a stop in front of Ugo's home. Giovanna and Teresa were sitting on the front porch waiting for their return. Carmine said, "We must do this again sometime." Ugo answered, "Yes. Sounds like a good idea. I'll see you soon." "Bye," they all replied in chorus. For the next several days, Ugo could not shake the phrase "golf nature" from his mind. He might be trying to sell an insurance policy to a client, but then he would look off into the distance as the phrase intruded and dominated his thoughts, so that the client would soon lose interest in Ugo's sales pitch. No matter what he did, the phrase dogged him and seemed to control all of his waking moments. He kept asking himself, what did Fujisaki mean when he said knowledge of golf nature is necessary to play great golf? The question had become an intolerable problem for him. He decided to seek the counsel of Desmond Fujisaki. "Ah, Mr. Rondello," Desmond Fujisaki greeted him. "How can I help you? I want you to tell me about golf nature." "You mean you want to take some golf lessons?" Fujisaki answered. "No, I want you to tell me what golf nature is." "Golf nature? I cannot tell you what it is. It is a personal revelation. It is discovered by the individual alone, sometimes by chance, but quite often it is achieved under the guidance of one who knows. A mentor is always helpful, sometimes a series of 6 lessons payable in advance as evidence of good faith can prepare the way and to establish the right spiritual conditions which might produce for you the desired knowledge and enlightenment. Driven by the necessity to resolve his problems, he agreed. "But first you must tell me what golf nature is," Ugo said. "I repeat, I cannot tell you what golf nature is, although I know what it is, and I know that I have it, but no one can tell you what it is. You must discover and experience it for yourself, because only your own light can be the source of your enlightenment, and only you can experience the golf nature you will have become. You will know it when you have it, because you have become the light that illuminates the darkness of your ignorance. I can only assist you in finding your own light." Ugo thought a while, then asked with some urgency, "How can I become enlightened?" "There are many ways to achieve this state of profound consciousness. First, you must assume the humble mindset of a student and accept the belief that you know nothing about golf and that you live in darkness. The 6 lessons I have proposed for you might help structure the conditions which are necessary to lead you to the discovery of your own light. In the first lesson, I will give you 1 question. If you answer it correctly and you accept it, It will cause you to cross the barrier of dark ignorance and thrust you into the state of enlightenment. If this effort fails, then in the second lesson I will give you another question, and so on, until you have achieved enlightenment. If all six lessons fail, I will return your money. Now contemplate carefully what I'm about to ask you to do. When you think you have the right answer, bring it to me. I will know if you are on the right path or the wrong one. When I know that it is the right answer, you too will know that it is the right answer, and it will then become your answer, and you will become that answer. But I cannot give it to you. Here is the first question. What is the trajectory of an unstruck golf ball? Ugo was about to answer him immediately, but Fujisaki cautioned, "Don't be hasty. Contemplate it for a few days." "But that's an absurd, unanswerable question," said Ugo. "No, it only seems unanswerable and absurd, for within the seemed absurdity you will find that it is a very meaningful and answerable question." You see, the purpose of asking seemingly absurd, unanswerable question in the Zen Buddhist tradition is to enlighten and liberate the mind, to shatter the wall of dark constraints which Western logic and language place on our knowledge of the world and of ourselves. When the individual has achieved enlightenment, he is then free of the limitations of logic and is now able to answer seemingly unanswerable questions, to see that which was formerly unseen and to know that which was formerly unknown, and that which was formerly opaquely absurd now becomes luminously clear in the fullness of his absurd meaningless. Ugo thought about Fujisaki's explanation for the next few days. It certainly sounded profound, eloquent, enigmatic, mysterious, but offered him no comfort, for he really did not understand what Fujisaki was saying. So he analyzed the question from every conceivable point of view he could imagine, and each time he found it completely illogical. An unstruck ball has no trajectory. It defies the laws of physics. But this absurdity is too obvious, so it cannot be the answer, Ugo said to himself as he dismissed Fujisaki's explanation. But then why did Fujisaki ask me this stupid question? He kept asking himself. He must have had a reason. If it is unanswerable, then what explanatory value could it have? Maybe that is a scam. Maybe I am being had by a clever Oriental con artist. But he offered me a money-back guarantee. Yes, but how good is his guarantee? He asked himself. I have already paid my fees anyway, so why not pursue this idiocy? What have I got to lose? He asked himself. So despite his deep skepticism about the entire enterprise, the burden of the paradoxical question became so intriguing and yet so disturbing that he decided to again confront his new mentor. "Mr. Fujisaki," Ugo began, "the question, what is the trajectory of an unstruck golf ball, is meaningless. It cannot be answered. My friend, you are wrong. Go back and come back after you have meditated upon it." "It is meaningless. It cannot be answered," Ugo insisted. But he returned home anyway and continued his frustrating attempt to find an answer to Fujisaki's question. He returned 2 days later and said to Fujisaki, "The question is meaningless and cannot be answered." "My friend, you are wrong. Go back and come back after you have meditated upon it." Ugo left completely bewildered, and 4 more times he returned with the same complaint and got the same response from Fujisaki. On his 7th return, he gave his mentor the same answer. "What is the trajectory of an unstruck golf ball is a meaningless and unanswerable question. Go back home and come back after you have contemplated the question again." But I gave you the same answer 7 times now, and each time you tell me to go back home and contemplate the question again. It's impossible to answer, Ugo said. Perhaps you are trying too hard. Do not try to force an answer, he said. Be patient. Forget about it, but don't forget about it. Keep it on the edge of consciousness. Look for the answer, but don't look for the answer. It will find you when you are ready to receive it. Seek to open the door of the dark, doorless room of foolish wisdom, and you will find the light of wise foolishness. You must make the interior man exterior and the exterior man the interior. When you see that they are one, you will know. And remember that what is also what is not, and what is not is also that which is. I can tell you nothing more. Fujisaki gently explained. He bowed, then left Ugo in a state of total confusion, but still aggressively determined to answer the unanswerable question and to pursue and achieve an understanding of, and therefore a possession of, golf nature. So disregarding Fujisaki's advice, during the next week, for an hour each day, Ugo sat in the lotus position under the fig tree in his backyard, trying to answer Fujisaki's question. At first, he merely sat there, trying to empty his mind, deliberately suppressing all the memories of both recent and past events. I will think of nothing. I will reject all thoughts about the present, the past, and the future. But the more he concentrated on not thinking, the more his mind became crowded with all kinds of thoughts and memories, some long forgotten, pleasant, but some were disturbing. Yet he persisted. I will make my mind become an empty vessel, he said. I will allow only golf nature to enter the emptiness of my mind and of my understanding. I will only think of myself sitting in the lotus position. He sat there in the uncomfortable position for an hour. His mind, however, was now occupied by the realization of the growing numbness which started to develop in his legs as a million other thoughts intruded into his consciousness. Admitting his failure to empty his mind, he tried to answer the question logically, trying to extract and examine the premise of the question to determine if it could be answered rationally. This, too, produced only frustration. He fasted for 3 days, hoping to cleanse his body and his mind to make it more receptive to an epiphany. On the third day, his dizziness and his hunger pangs nearly overwhelmed him, so he broke his fast, but he would not give up his quest. He had now become so obsessed with Fujisaki's question that no matter where he was or what he did or what he was doing, it dominated his attention like an imperious itch which demands to be scratched, which cannot be reached. He was miserable. Ugo and Teresa were having their usual Sunday spaghetti dinner. Teresa was noisily eating and talking about her sister Giovanna, who was complaining about her husband Carmine because he was spending so much time at the golf course and that he was neglecting the yard, the children, his business, and that he was even neglecting her. "I think you are too much interested in this golf thing that has gotten hold of you," Teresa said. Ugo was in another world, so he did not hear her. He just ate his spaghetti silently, indifferently, unemotionally, showing no enthusiasm for the pasta that he often claimed he dearly loved. He methodically raised one forkful after another to his mouth, chewed, then swallowed, without making any of the normal noises of contentment. Teresa kept chattering relentlessly. Ugo filled his fourth glass of wine, raised it toward his mouth, but his arm froze in midair. He rose to his feet. His head seemed to be bathed in light like the halo around the heads of saints. his face turned pale, his eyes turned upward, his breathing labored. "I have found it," he whispered hoarsely. Then his voice gradually rose to a shout. "I have found it! I have found it! I have found it!" Then he laughed wildly. "I know the answer to Fujisaki's unanswerable question." His poor wife, startled at this outburst, became frightened by his behavior. "What's the matter? What's the matter?" she kept repeating as she rushed to his side to see if she could help him. "Are you not feeling well? Is there something wrong with the spaghetti?" Ugo, his legs a little unsteady, sat down, his face wet with sweat, his hands clammy and trembling. He smiled broadly and said, "I feel fine. Wonderful. I have never felt better in my life. And the spaghetti was wonderful also." He raised his glass of wine, looked heavenward, and said, "My dearest Teresa, I want you to join me in a toast to the new man. Tonight I found the answer to Fujisaki's unanswerable question, and I was happily born again as an enlightened man who knows and possesses golf nature." Ugo has returned to the game and continues to shoot mediocre to poor golf. He never breaks 90. He still hooks, slices, and frequently misses the ball completely. Yet he never curses or complains. He even praises the game. But sometimes he hits a magnificent shot. However, good shots or bad, he plays happily and serenely, secure in the protective embrace of his golf nature knowledge.
Golf is a four-letter word. The ball arced into the air, straight at the pin. But it reached its apogee too early and fell like a chaney-shot quail. The ball hit the water and disappeared into the murky depths of the lake. We were playing in a Fresno State-sponsored tournament at Sierra Vista Golf Course, now the Quail Lake Subdivision, behind a foursome who had been holding us up all day. Our foursome was putting out on the 16th green when we observed the duffer's errant shot. I elbowed my partner and said sotto voce, "Hey, Ed, did you see that?" "Yeah, that's going to slow them up even more. Glad we're almost to the 19th. I could use a drink." The miscreant went up to the designated drop area, disgustedly threw down a ball, selected a different club, and swung mightily. The club hit the ground well behind the ball. Dirt and grass flew everywhere, and the ball skittered into the lake. Now we were finished putting and were standing in a row at the top of the 16th green, covering our mouths to keep from laughing out loud. The hacker looked back at us, frowned, dropped another ball, and promptly sent it to a watery grave. He reached into his bag and pulled out another spheroid, but the result didn't change. We stood with looks of awe on our face. "Four shots deep six," Ed announced. "I've never seen anything like it." "Yeah, only in the movie Tin Cup," the third member of our group rejoined. "What do you think you'll do now?" I whispered. "Who knows? His head's probably so hot he could fry eggs. And Ed picked up his bag. The frustrated golfer went to the pull cart carrying his golf bag and clubs, picked it up, walked over to the lake, and sent the whole kit and caboodle into a watery grave. In a few seconds, all that remained were a few bubbles and widening ripples. He never made a sound except for a grunt when he made the throw. The remaining view of this poor human being was his retreating back as he stomped off toward the parking lot several hundred yards away. After re-zipping the pocket, he lifted the bag and cart over his head, walked to the lake, and threw them as far as he could. Again, we were convulsed with laughter, but for the guy who had just deposited $1,200 worth of golf gear into the lake, it was the end of the line. I think he would agree. Golf is a four-letter word.
That was Angelo Angarano reading Born Again Golfer and David Creighton reading Golf, a four-lettered word. In our first story, we heard all about Hugo Rondello. Hugo has been playing golf for 20 years with a score hardly ever better than 89 when one day he came across a thesis written by a PhD which gave him many reasons to acknowledge the game's absurdity. The real reason, so the PhD declared, that man started to play this crazy game was because thousands and thousands of years ago he wanted to be good at defending himself so he could use a tree limb to crush his enemy's skulls. But nowadays, the writer continued, golf is only good for therapy. Well, Hugo didn't want any more therapy. But then he found a new pro at his golf club who turned out to be a Zen Buddhist. This one talked him into taking lessons, and in order to find the answer to the question, what is the trajectory of an unhit golf ball? And even though he never did figure out the answer to that question, he started playing again, still hooking and slicing, but having fun. And in the second story, David Creighton describes how some golfers out there on the course witnessed the player in front of them shoot three consecutive golf balls right into a lake. It evidently upset him so much that he threw his whole golf cart and all that was in it directly into that same lake. The observers concluded that the hacker probably tossed well over $1,000 worth of golf paraphernalia into that lake. Golf, is it a great game or just a four-lettered word? Friends, all we know is that there are thousands of golf courses in the United States and millions of golfers who use them. All of them probably have many more stories, experiences, and feelings about the game. Good, bad, or indifferent, the game keeps on being popular and well attended. Friends, our first author, Angelo Angarano, is a friend of mine. He was born in Fresno, attended Fresno State, and got an MA in philosophy at Stanford. For some time, he taught at Roosevelt High School in Fresno, but then transferred to Fresno City College, where he and I were colleagues for well over 20 years. And even though the story was about a physical game where you have to hit a little ball time after time, somehow Angelo can't hide the fact that his real interest in life is philosophy. You know, all that stuff about Zen Buddhism and the like. Of course, in the end, we're glad that, even though he's still slicing and missing, Hugo Rondello was having a good time playing golf. And after all, that's what really counts. As far as our second author, David Creighton, is concerned, he's been taking writing classes from Janice Stevens, who, as many of you might remember, is another one of the fine authors we get to listen to on Valley Writers Read. We thank David for tonight's story and hope he sends us more. And believe it or not, he's another person that I've known for many, many years. As a matter of fact, well over 30 years ago, he was actually one of my bosses, inasmuch as he was on the board of trustees at Fresno City College, where I was an instructor. And so we come to the close of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Sally Stallings. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.